F1, number 21B.
What the prophet says is that that Christ which brings about that spiritual consciousness is also that Christ which in Zephaniah brings the wiping away of all that is error and freeing the idea so completely from error that each idea is reinstated in its wholeness. So we come to Zephaniah. Zephaniah now would say, you see, just goes one step further from Habakkuk. Says, if you have fulfilled Habakkuk, don't let that standpoint, don't let that last touch go, you see. Stay there. Then you begin to see that that enforces the disappearance of the outward error and the establishment of the idea in its purity. So Zephaniah gives that law of demonstration from the point of view of the Christ, where Christ says constantly, I am mind. I give you now the law of Zephaniah, where the Christ says constantly, mind as a Christ, and mind as the Christ is constantly translating itself to the point of idea. How? By bringing to disappearance all that is unlike mind, by consuming all that is unlike mind, and thereby freeing the idea of everything that is unlike mind, and showing the idea of mind in its fullness. We stand in awe before the presence of the Lord. So, in this law of Zephaniah, see, you always have that God, as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, that God consumes its counterfeit, and by doing that, the remnant which is left over, is always seen in its fulfilled sense, always seen as one with God. So mind, we can know as a prophet, spiritually, being conscious of the spiritual fact. Of what fact? That mind as a Christ and constantly comes and consumes everything which is unlike mind, and thereby freeing the remnant of all the veil and the veiling, and showing that the idea of mind was always one with mind. Then we stand in the presence of the Lord. That spirit constantly comes to you and to me and to every problem and consumes everything which is unlike spirit. It consumes materiality, impurity, duality, and what is left over is the idea of spirit in its fullness. It is sanctified. The people is sanctified, and they just have the adorable one. Then soul is a fact in being, and soul has a Christ. And in Zephaniah, soul comes as that Christ to every problem and consumes all that is unlike soul. Completely all that is unlike soul. There we have that day of fire, that day of trouble, that day of gloominess, and that day of desolation, and so on. All that day of the fires consuming everything which is not sinless. And thereby leaving over that idea of soul which is seen always in the fullness of soul. The day of the Lord. And that day of the Lord is great, and so on. He shows that. Then he shows principle And in principle, we can always see, when principle has a, as principle has a Christ, we can always see that principle comes to every problem with one big intention, just to sweep away everything which is not unprincipled. It just does not stop until everything which is not principled is swept away, and then what is left over is the idea of principle in its wholeness, in its system, gathered together, disciplined, as Zephaniah says. Then we can see that life has a Christ, and so we just can be conscious of that life, the one life, the eternal life, the only life, which has a Christ, and therefore constantly comes to every situation as the one life, and just does not rest, and does not rest, until everything which is unlike life is swept away, is consumed. So that when everything is swept away, then the idea of life is revealed in its wholeness as that idea of life where everyone in his own way, but from all the isles, are having the one God and worshipping the one God in its individual way, but in a universal sense. And it shows truth, the wholeness of truth, as truth, which is a fact in being. A fact in being, we can't deny that. But the signs of life, the signs of being, does not alone state facts. It has a Christ. It knows that it has a Christ. So truth has a Christ, and therefore that truth is not slumbering nor stagnant, but it comes and works and works and works on every problem, until not just a bit of error is swept away, but until all error is swept away, so that the idea of truth is completely revealed, laid bare, so to say, laid open, so to say, and that we can only see the idea in its right place, in its rightness, divine righteousness. Then we begin to see that love is a fact in being, and that fact in being states that love never loses sight of loveliness, but also that love wants to draw every idea back to herself, to draw every idea back to its fulfillment. But this fact has a Christ. It's not just a statement. It has a Christ, and so the prophet shows that this fact as a Christ is constantly at work, and at work in the universe. In the whole universe as the way of salvation, bringing back every idea back to God, and bringing it back to God through the world order, and then showing that when it is brought back to God, that love will protect it and encompass it so that it can never be any more touched by error. And that he does through the reversed world order. Where we see how God rejoices over thee and praises over thee, where each manifestation of mind and of God is for a fame and for a praise for God. And so the idea is now brought back to God through that Christ impulsion which goes through all the prophets. That's what he shows. I don't know if it was possible for you to follow all from stage to stage, but little by little these prophets in their laws, and it's especially the laws, the standpoint and the law which I want to show you, because I feel they are practical. Because we know the synonyms. Each one of us know now the synonyms and the ideas. And if we can begin to see that we can use the word order, say, from various standpoints, for various fundamental claims, each one of us can gain an enormous wide field of practice of using the divine facts. See, the moment really, you see, what I had in mind at the beginning, when I wanted to give these talks, was I thought each one knows now the ideas of the synonyms. We have studied them, over and over. And then I felt, when I began to see these prophets, I felt how wonderful it would be if I would be able just to show how in many ways, but in a definite way each time, not in an indefinite way, but in a definite way, each one could make use of that enormous capital, that spiritual capital, which each one of us has gained. That capital, with capital I mean that wealth of knowing the synonyms, of knowing the seven. How to make use of that capital in a definite way and not in a haphazard way. Can you see that? Because I feel you have you don't have to learn, if we want to use the term learning, you don't have to learn really very much in addition to it. Only to see that one can use these seven from various standpoints, and that those various standpoints are not haphazard standpoints, but that they are defined through the 16. Through the framework of the Holy City. And so I felt that if I could only achieve that, and that's really the main thing I want to achieve, I could have a feeling that you would be able to go home and use it. Because it doesn't need much more, what I would say, research or study or learning, of additional learning, so to say, but just a training in the standpoints within the system of science. And then I felt then these ideas will have more power, will have more purpose, will be more definite, and will do a more practical job. So, we go on now to the last triad, to Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Now, let me just try to see if I can convey the general denominator of these three prophets. They are very different, again, from all the foregoing triads. They are post-exilic prophets, all three of them. And between the pre-exilic prophets, minor prophets, and the post-exilic minor prophets lie about three quarter of a century or so. So it's quite a bit of time of spiritual thinking, you see, where change has gone, where consciousness is broadening out and is become deeper, that experience of the Babylonian captivity, of the exile, has left some impress on men, just as every hard experience which we go through doesn't leave us untouched, we come out of it with a firmer, with a deeper insight. And so it was also with the prophets. Up to the exile, we know how religion turned around the temple in Jerusalem, turned around the documents, the priests, rites, feasts, and so on. Then when the temple, the center of Judaic worship, was broken down, taken away from the people, when they were sent to Babylon with just their little belongings they had on themselves, they couldn't take the temple away, all the gold and the silver instruments and vessels and so on were taken by the conquerors away, so that they had nothing left which was in a religious, nothing left of their religion except the documents, the scrolls they hid under their garments and carried them away into Babylon. And so we can begin to see that another object, so to say, of religious worship had to be instituted in the place of temple and feasts and altars and priests and I don't know what. And we know that in the exile, really the book, the scroll, became the center of worship. Instead of the material temple and its rites, the book, the words, the letter, the writings became the center of religion. And so in that time, religion changed from a ritual religion to a religion of learning, of knowing, a religion of understanding, a religion of science. That was the first time in human history, in every culture, that such an abstract sense of religion was being born. All other religions had their temples and had their groves and had their altars and had their feasts and had their singings and had their music and etc. etc. And for the first time the Christ just pushed that receptive sense which was in Israel, pushed it a step forward to say, you know, God is a God which is abstract, which is not tangible, so to say, with physical senses, and it is a God and a religion which is to be learned and understood and searched with your heart. So in Babylon, they began to copy those rare documents, though that in each little community where they were, spread all over the Babylonic Empire, in each community they had the written law. And they would have perhaps one copy in each place, and they would gather together all Jews around that one who could read, and that was their worship of God. One sitting down, having the scroll, reading it out, all the other ones listening, can we understand it, what it means? No more feasts, no more sacrifices, no more all these things. No more gold and silver vessels, no more temples. It was becoming a religion of the heart, that which the pre-exilic prophets were prophesying would come. So there they were, sitting in the middle, a scribe or somebody who could read, perhaps taking it in turns, the others who couldn't read sitting around and listening. And so little by little the truth was established in the heart of men. And the religion of outward worship was changed into a more abstract religion of understanding. It's there where we know how the big documents were re-edited, republished, where the priestly document was written, where everything became systematized, where the days of creation were written, where the system of their religion was being found out. You know, the priestly document is characterized by its stereotyped structure. Everything which we read in the Bible which has a stereotyped recurrence, they are all taken out from the priestly documents. And so it indicates, you see, that at that point where they were deprived of everything that tried to distract them from the deeper understanding of God, that they began to systematize their thought, to see more and more of the science of what they were feeling. And then, when the time came, when they could go back, when the Persians and the Medes were conquering the Babylonians and were under the kings of the Medes, the Jews had high places of office where they were allowed now to go back to Jerusalem, to their home country. They were now concerned in rebuilding the temple. Now, that seems as if it would be a step backward. First, the temple had been destroyed, and they made a step forward to seeing the signs of it. And now one thinks, oh, they go back to their old ways of worship. But it isn't so. And that is what the post-exilic prophets want to show. It's certain that outwardly they were concerned with rebuilding the temple, and the three prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, were all concerned with the temple, with the building of the temple, with the structure of the temple, and with the service in the temple. But they were concerned with it in a very different way than in the pre-exilic period. Friends, if you once want to have a thrill with the Bible, just go once through the concordance of the Bible and look up, say, everything that is said about the temple in a chronological way, going from Genesis to Revelation, and see how that concept of temple changed and changed and changed. The term remained the same, temple. But what it meant was undergoing an enormous change. When the first temple was built in Solomon's time, you know, which had its predecessor in the tabernacle. Can you say predecessor? Yeah. As a tabernacle, you see. When one reads there, the whole interest, so to say, was concerned for the measures of the temple, the arrangement within the temple, how it should be built, with what material it should be built, in which measures it should be built, how high, and the courts and everything. It was shown that, you see, because it symbolized in a material way the idea that was shown on the mountain. When we come to the rebuilding of the temple in the prophetic age, and we read about the building of the temple, we hear very little about the material they used and the measures it was built and how it was arranged in the temple and so on. Practically nothing. But what we hear about the building of that temple was, with what spiritual attitude are you going to build it? See, so the accent changes over in the prophetic age to the spiritual consciousness with which that temple, that symbol of the tabernacle was being, that symbol of that original idea which Moses saw on the mount was being built. So it wasn't so much the temple that is the focus of interest, but with what inward attitude are we building the temple of God? And then you know how later on, in the New Testament, the temple again is something else. How in the New Testament, Jesus and Paul speak about the body as the temple, speak about the true consciousness as being the temple, that it is the temple built without hands. Do you not know that we are the temple of the living God? And so on, you see, the temple meant again something very different. It meant our consciousness and the using of that consciousness. And then finally, in Revelation, again, that sense was changed. And we suddenly hear that the Lord is the temple thereof, that God is the temple thereof, and so on. And finally, there was no more temple therein. Just indicates four big stages how the sense of temple, which is defined in the textbook as the idea of life, substance, and intelligence, as the superstructure of truth, and as the shrine of love. See, it isn't life, truth, and love. It is the idea of life. And I think, in a broader way, Haggai will tell us the idea of life. What is the idea of life? And then I think Zechariah tells us the superstructure of truth. He doesn't show the structure of truth. He doesn't show truth itself. But he shows the superstructure of truth. And then Malachi shows the shrine of love. Shows that temple as that shrine of love, where we worship at the shrine of love, and how we should worship in that shrine of love, how we should worship in that temple. Or in other words, we will see in this next triad, the common denominator is the temple as a symbol. As a symbol of the idea of God, but it is shown in Haggai, what idea should rule us in building a temple? In other words, what is the idea of life which is operating in our life? And how can we build that life which is an idea of life? That's what he's going to show. And then Zechariah shows really the superstructure of truth. He shows that temple and shows the spiritual structure of the temple. He doesn't show at all if that temple is 10 feet wide or 10 feet high or 20 feet long or so, if it's built with wood and iron or with gold and silver and so on, nothing of that sort. But he shows the spiritual structure, the spiritual calculus, which is the temple.